Things Fall Apart, Disc 3.
Chapter 9. For the first time in 3 nights, Okonkwo slept. He woke up once in the middle of the night, and his mind went back to the past 3 days without making him feel uneasy. He began to wonder why he had felt uneasy at all. It was like a man wondering in broad daylight why a dream had appeared so terrible to him at night. He stretched himself and scratched his thigh where a mosquito had bitten him as he slept. Another one was wailing near his right ear. He slapped the ear and hoped he had killed it. Why do they always go for one's ears? When he was a child, his mother had told him a story about it. But it was as silly as all women's stories. Mosquito, she had said, had asked Ear to marry him, whereupon Ear fell on the floor in uncontrollable laughter. How much longer do you think you will live? She asked. You are already a skeleton. Mosquito went away humiliated, and any time he passed her way, he told Ear that he was still alive. Okonkwo turned on his side and went back to sleep. He was roused in the morning by someone banging on his door. "Who is that?" he growled. He knew it must be Akwaefi. Of his 3 wives, Akwaefi was the only one who would have the audacity to bang on his door. "Azinma is dying," came her voice, and all the tragedy and sorrow of her life were packed in those words. Okonkwo sprang from his bed, pushed back the bolt on his door, and ran to Akwaefi's hut. Azinma lay shivering on a mat beside a huge fire that her mother had kept burning all night. "It is Iba," said Okonkwo, as he took his machete and went to the bush to collect the leaves and grasses and barks of trees that went into making the medicine for Iba. Akwaefi knelt beside the sick child, occasionally feeling with her palm the wet, burning forehead. Azinma was an only child and the center of her mother's world. Very often, it was Azinma who decided what food her mother should prepare. Akwaefi even gave her such delicacies as eggs, which children were rarely allowed to eat because such food tempted them to steal. One day, as Azinma was eating an egg, Okonkwo had come in unexpectedly from his hut. He was greatly shocked and swore to beat Akwaefi if she dared to give the child eggs again. But it was impossible to refuse Azinma anything. After her father's rebuke, she developed an even keener appetite for eggs. And she enjoyed, above all, the secrecy in which she now ate them. Her mother always took her into their bedroom and shut the door. Azinma did not call her mother Ne, like all children. She called her by her name, Akwaefi, as her father and other grown-up people did. The relationship between them was not only that of mother and child. There was something in it like the companionship of equals, which was strengthened by such little conspiracies as eating eggs in the bedroom. Akwaefi had suffered a good deal in her life. She had borne 10 children, and 9 of them had died in infancy, usually before the age of 3. As she buried one child after another, her sorrow gave way to despair, and then to grim resignation. The birth of her children, which should be a woman's crowning glory, became for Akwaefi a mere physical agony devoid of promise. The naming ceremony after 7 market weeks became an empty ritual. Her deepening despair found expression in the names she gave her children. One of them was a pathetic cry. Onwumbiko, Death, I implore you. But Death took no notice. Onwumbiko died in his 15th month. The next child was a girl, Og så jeg mener, may it not happen again. She died in her 11th month, and two others after her. Ekwefi then became defiant, and called her next child Onwuma. Death may please himself. And he did. After the death of Ekwefi's second child, Okonkwo had gone to a medicine man, who was also a diviner of the Afa Oracle, to inquire what was amiss. This man told him that the child was an Ogbanje, one of those wicked children who, when they died, entered their mother's wombs to be born again. When your wife becomes pregnant again, he said, let her not sleep in her hut. Let her go and stay with her people. In that way, she will elude her wicked tormentor and break its evil cycle of birth and death. Ekwefi did as she was asked. As soon as she became pregnant, she went to live with her old mother in another village. It was there that her third child was born and circumcised on the 8th day. She did not return to Okonkwo's compound until 3 days before the naming ceremony. The child was called Onwumbiko. Onwumbiko was not given proper burial when he died. Okonkwo had called in another medicine man, who was famous in the clan for his great knowledge about Ogbanje children. His name was Okagbwe Uyanwa. Okagbwe was a very striking figure, tall, with a full beard and a bald head. He was light in complexion, and his eyes were red and fiery. He always gnashed his teeth as he listened to those who came to consult him. He asked Okonkwo a few questions about the dead child. All the neighbors and relations who had come to mourn gathered round them. On what market day was it born? He asked. Oye, replied Okonkwo. And it died this morning? Okonkwo said yes, and only then realized for the first time that the child had died on the same market day as it had been born. The neighbors and relations also saw the coincidence and said among themselves that it was very significant. Where do you sleep with your wife? In your obi or in her own hut? Asked the medicine man. In her hut. In future, call her into your obi. The medicine man then ordered that there should be no mourning for the dead child. He brought out a sharp razor from the goatskin bag slung from his left shoulder and began to mutilate the child. Then he took it away to bury in the evil forest, holding it by the ankle and dragging it on the ground behind him. After such treatment, it would think twice before coming again, unless it was one of the stubborn ones who returned, carrying the stamp of their mutilation, a missing finger, or perhaps a dark line where the medicine man's razor had cut them. By the time Onwumbiko died, Ekwefi had become a very bitter woman. Her husband's first wife had already had 3 sons, all strong and healthy. When she had borne her 3rd son in succession, Okonkwo had gathered a goat for her, as was the custom. Ekwefi had nothing but good wishes for her, but she had grown so bitter about her own chi that she could not rejoice with others over their good fortune. And so, on the day that Moye's mother celebrated the birth of her 3 sons with feasting and music, Ekwefi was the only person in the happy company who went about with a cloud on her brow. Her husband's wife took this for malevolence, as husbands' wives were wont to. How could she know that Ekwefi's bitterness did not flow outwards to others, but inwards, into her own soul? That she did not blame others for their good fortune, but her own evil chi, who denied her any. At last, Ezinma was born, and although ailing, she seemed determined to live. At first, Ekwefi accepted her, as she had accepted others, with listless resignation. But when she lived on to her fourth, fifth, and sixth years, love returned once more to her mother, and with the love, anxiety. She determined to nurse her child to health, and she put all her being into it. She was rewarded by occasional spells of health, during which Ezinma bubbled with energy like fresh palm wine. At such times, she seemed beyond danger. But all of a sudden, she would go down again. Everybody knew she was an Ogbanje. These sudden bouts of sickness and health were typical of her kind. But she had lived so long that perhaps she had decided to stay. Some of them did become tired of their evil rounds of birth and death, or took pity on their mothers, and stayed. Ekwefi believed deep inside her that Ezinma had come to stay. She believed because it was that faith alone that gave her own life any kind of meaning. And this faith had been strengthened when a year or so ago a medicine man had dug up Ezinma's Iyi Uwa. Everyone knew then that she would live because her bond with the world of Ogbanje had been broken. Ekwefi was reassured. But such was her anxiety for her daughter that she could not rid herself completely of her fear. And although she believed that the Iyi Uwa, which had been dug up, was genuine, she could not ignore the fact that some really evil children sometimes misled people into digging up a specious one. But Ezinma's Iyi Uwa had looked real enough. It was a smooth pebble wrapped in a dirty rag. The man who dug it up was the same Okagbwe, who was famous in all the clan for his knowledge in these matters. Ezinma had not wanted to cooperate with him at first, but that was only to be expected. No Ogbanje would yield her secrets easily, and most of them never did because they died too young, before they could be asked questions. "Where did you bury your Iyi Uwa?" Okagbwe asked Ezinma. She was 9 then, and was just recovering from a serious illness. "What is Iyi Uwa?" she asked in return. "You know what it is. You buried it in the ground somewhere, so that you can die and return again to torment your mother." Ezinma looked at her mother, whose eyes, sad and pleading, were fixed on her.
"Answer the question at once," roared Okonkwo, who stood beside her.
All the family were there, and some of the neighbors too.
"Leave her to me," the medicine man told Okonkwo in a cool, confident voice. He turned again to Ezinma. "Where did you bury your Iyi Uwa?"
"Where they bury children," she replied, and the quiet spectators murmured to themselves.
"Come along, then, and show me the spot," said the medicine man.
The crowd set out with Ezinma leading the way, and Okagbwe following closely behind her. Okonkwo came next, and Ekwefe followed him. When she came to the main road, Ezinma turned left, as if she was going to the stream.
"But you said it was where they bury the children," asked the medicine man.
"No," said Ezinma, whose feeling of importance was manifest in her sprightly walk. She sometimes broke into a run and stopped again suddenly. The crowd followed her silently. Women and children returning from the stream with pots of water on their heads wondered what was happening until they saw Okagbwe and guessed that it must be something to do with Ogbanje. They all knew Ekwefi and her daughter very well. When she got to the big Udala tree, Ezinma turned left into the bush, and the crowd followed her. Because of her size, she made her way through trees and creepers more quickly than her followers.
The bush was alive with the tread of feet on dry leaves and sticks, and the moving aside of tree branches. Izinma went deeper and deeper, and the crowd went with her. Then she suddenly turned round and began to walk back to the road. Everybody stood to let her pass, and then filed after her.
"If you bring us all this way for nothing, I shall beat sense into you," Okonkwo threatened.
"I have told you to let her alone. I know how to deal with them," said Okagbwe. Izinma led the way back to the road, looked left and right, and turned right. And so they arrived home again. "Where did you bury your Iyi Uwa?" asked Okagbwe, when Izinma finally stopped outside her father's obi. Okagbwe's voice was unchanged. It was quiet and confident.
"It is near that orange tree," Izinma said.
"And why did you not say so, you wicked daughter of Akalagoli?" Okonkwo swore furiously. The medicine man ignored him.
"Come and show me the exact spot," he said quietly to Izinma.
"It is here," she said,
when they got to the tree. "Point at the spot with your finger," said Okagbwe.
"It is here," said Izinma, touching the ground with her finger.
Okonkwo stood by, rumbling like thunder in the rainy season. "Bring me a hoe," said Okagbwe. When Ekwefi brought the hoe, he had already put aside his goatskin bag and his big cloth, and was in his underwear, a long and thin strip of cloth, wound round the waist like a belt, and then passed between the legs, to be fastened to the belt behind. He immediately set to work digging a pit where Izinma had indicated. The neighbors sat around watching the pit becoming deeper and deeper. The dark topsoil soon gave way to the bright red earth with which women scrubbed the floors and walls of huts. Okagbwe worked tirelessly and in silence, his back shining with perspiration. Okonkwo stood by the pit. He asked Okagbwe to come up and rest while he took a hand. But Okagbwe said he was not tired yet. Ekwefi went into her hut to cook yams. Her husband had brought out more yams than usual because the medicine man had to be fed. Izinma went with her and helped in preparing the vegetables.
"There is too much green vegetable," she said.
"Don't you see the pot is full of yams?" Ekwefi asked. "And you know how leaves become smaller after cooking."
"Yes," said Izinma. "That was why the snake lizard killed his mother."
"Very true," said Ekwefi.
"He gave his mother 7 baskets of vegetables to cook, and in the end there were only 3. And so he killed her," said Izinma.
"That is not the end of the story."
"Oho," said Izinma. "I remember now. He brought another 7 baskets and cooked them himself. And there were again only 3. So he killed himself too."
Outside the obi, Okagbwe and Okonkwo were digging the pit to find where Izinma had buried her Iyi Uwa. Neighbors sat around watching. The pit was now so deep that they no longer saw the digger. They only saw the red earth he threw up mounting higher and higher. Okonkwo's son, Nwoye, stood near the edge of the pit because he wanted to take in all that happened. Okagbwe had again taken over the digging from Okonkwo. He worked as usual, in silence. The neighbors and Okonkwo's wives were now talking. The children had lost interest and were playing. Suddenly, Okagbwe sprang to the surface with the agility of a leopard. "It is very near now," he said. "I have felt it." There was immediate excitement, and those who were sitting jumped to their feet. "Call your wife and child," he said to Okonkwo. But Ekwefi and Ezinma had heard the noise and run out to see what it was. Okagwe went back into the pit, which was now surrounded by spectators. After a few more hoefuls of earth, he struck the Iyi-Uwa. He raised it carefully with the hoe and threw it to the surface. Some women ran away in fear when it was thrown, but they soon returned, and everyone was gazing at the rag from a reasonable distance. Okagwe emerged, and without saying a word or even looking at the spectators, he went to his goatskin bag, took out 2 leaves, and began to chew them. When he had swallowed them, he took up the rag with left hand and began to untie it. And then the smooth, shiny pebble fell out. He picked it up. "Is this yours?" he asked Ezinma. "Yes," she replied. All the women shouted with joy, because Ekwefi's troubles were at last ended. All this had happened more than a year ago, and Ezima had not been ill since. And then, suddenly, she had begun to shiver in the night. Ekwefi brought her to the fireplace, spread her mat on the floor, and built a fire. But she had got worse and worse. As she knelt by her, feeling with her palm the wet, burning forehead, she prayed 1,000 times. Although her husband's wives were saying that it was nothing more than Iba, she did not hear them. Okonkwo returned from the bush, carrying on his left shoulder a large bundle of grasses and leaves, roots and barks of medicinal trees and shrubs. He went into Ekwefi's hut, put down his load, and sat down. "Get me a pot," he said, "and leave the child alone." Ekwefi went to bring the pot, and Okonkwo selected the best from his bundle, in their due proportions, and cut them up. He put them in the pot, and Ekwefi poured in some water. "Is that enough?" she asked, when she had poured in about half of the water in the bowl. "A little more. I said a little. Are you deaf?" Okonkwo roared at her. She set the pot on the fire, and Okonkwo took up his machete to return to his obi. "You must watch the pot carefully," he said as he went, "and don't allow it to boil over. If it does, its power will be gone." He went away to his hut, and Ekwefi began to tend the medicine pot almost as if it was itself a sick child. Her eyes went constantly from Ezinma to the boiling pot and back to Ezinma. Okonkwo returned when he felt the medicine had cooked long enough. He looked it over and said it was done. "Bring me a low stool for Ezinma," he said, "and a thick mat." He took down the pot from the fire and placed it in front of the stool. He then roused Ezinma and placed her on the stool astride the steaming pot. The thick mat was thrown over both. Ezinma struggled to escape from the choking and overpowering steam, but she was held down. She started to cry. When the mat was at last removed, she was drenched in perspiration. Ekwefi mopped her with a piece of cloth, and she lay down on a dry mat and was soon asleep. Chapter 10. Large crowds began to gather on the village Ilo as soon as the edge had worn off the sun's heat and it was no longer painful on the body. Most communal ceremonies took place at that time of the day, so that even when it was said that a ceremony would begin after the midday meal, everyone understood that it would begin a long time later, when the sun's heat had softened. It was clear from the way the crowd stood or sat that the ceremony was for men. There were many women, but they looked on from the fringe like outsiders. The titled men and elders sat on their stools, waiting for the trials to begin. In front of them was a row of stools on which nobody sat. There were nine of them. Two little groups of people stood at a respectable distance beyond the stools. They faced the elders. There were three men in one group, and three men and one woman in the other. The woman was Mbafo, and the three men with her were her brothers. In the other group were her husband, Uzowulu, and his relatives. Mbafo and her brothers were as still as statues into whose faces the artist has molded defiance. Uzowulu and his relative, on the other hand, were whispering together. It looked like whispering, but they were really talking at the top of their voices. Everybody in the crowd was talking. It was like the market. From a distance, the noise was a deep rumble carried by the wind. An iron gong sounded, setting up a wave of expectation in the crowd. Everyone looked in the direction of the Egwugwu house. Gom, 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 went the gong, and a powerful flute blew a high-pitched blast. Then came the voices of the Egwugwu, guttural and awesome. The wave struck the women and children, and there was a backward stampede, but it was momentary. They were already far enough where they stood, and there was room for running away if any of the Egwugwu should go towards them. The drum sounded again, and the flute blew. The Egwugwu house was now a pandemonium of quavering voices. Aru oyim de 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 dei filled the air as the spirits of the ancestors, just emerged from the earth, greeted themselves in their esoteric language. The Egwugwu house into which they emerged faced the forest, away from the crowd, who saw only its back with the many colored patterns and drawings done by specially chosen women at regular intervals. These women never saw the inside of the hut. No woman ever did. They scrubbed and painted the outside walls under the supervision of men. If they imagined what was inside, they kept their imagination to themselves. No woman ever asked questions about the most powerful and the most secret cult in the clan. Aru oyim de 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 dei flew around the dark, closed hut like tongues of fire. The ancestral spirits of the clan were abroad. The metal gong beat continuously now, and the flute, shrill and powerful, floated on the chaos. And then the Egwugwu appeared. The women and children sent up a great shout and took to their heels. It was instinctive. A woman fled as soon as an Egwugwu came in sight. And when, as on that day, nine of the greatest masked spirits in the clan came out together, it was a terrifying spectacle. Even Mbafo took to her heels and had to be restrained by her brothers. Each of the nine Egwugwu represented a village of the clan. Their leader was called Evil Forest. Smoke poured out of his head. The nine villages of Umwofia had grown out of the nine sons of the first father of the clan. Evil Forest represented the village of Umweru, or the children of Eru, who was the eldest of the nine sons. Umwofia Kwenu, shouted the leading Egwugwu, pushing the air with his raffia arms. The elders of the clan replied, Ya! Umwofia Kwenu! Ya! Umwofia Kwenu! Ya! Evil Forest then thrust the pointed end of his rattling staff into the earth, and it began to shake and rattle, like something agitating with a metallic life. He took the first of the empty stools, and the eight other Egwugwu began to sit in order of seniority after him. Okonkwo's wives, and perhaps other women as well, might have noticed that the second Degwugwu had the springy walk of Okonkwo. And they might also have noticed that Okonkwo was not among the titled men and elders who sat behind the row of Egwugwu. But if they thought these things, they kept them within themselves. The Egwugwu, with a springy walk, was one of the dead fathers of the clan. He looked terrible with a smoked raffia body, a huge wooden face painted white, except for the round, hollow eyes and the charred teeth that were as big as a man's fingers. On his head were two powerful horns. When all the Egwugwu had sat down and the sound of the many tiny bells and rattles on their bodies had subsided, Evil Forest addressed the two groups of people facing them. "Uzowulu's body, I salute you," he said. Spirits always addressed humans as bodies. Uzowulu bent down and touched the earth with his right hand as a sign of submission. "Our father, my hand has touched the ground," he said. "Uzowulu's body, do you know me?" asked the spirit. "How can I know you, father? You are beyond our knowledge." Evil Forest then turned to the other group and addressed the eldest of the three brothers. "The body of Odukwe, I greet you," he said. And Odukwe bent down and touched the earth. The hearing then began. Uzowulu stepped forward and presented his case. "That woman standing there is my wife, Mbafo. I married her with my money and my yams. I do not owe my in-laws anything. I owe them no yams. I owe them no cocoa yams. One morning, three of them came to my house, beat me up, and took my wife and children away. This happened in the rainy season. I have waited in vain for my wife to return. At last, I went to my in-laws and said to them, 'You have taken back your sister. I did not send her away. You yourselves took her. The law of the clan is that you should return her bride price.' But my wife's brothers said they had nothing to tell me. So I have brought the matter to the fathers of the clan. My case is finished. I salute you." "Your words are good," said the leader of the Gwugwu. "Let us hear Odukwe. His words may also be good." Odukwe was short and thick-set. He stepped forward, saluted the spirits, and began his story. "My in-law has told you that we went to his house, beat him up, and took our sister and her children away. All that is true. He told you that he came to take back her bride price, and we refused to give it him. That also is true. My in-law, Uzowulu, is a beast. My sister lived with him for 9 years. During those years, no single day passed in the sky without his beating the woman. We have tried to settle their quarrels, time without number, and on each occasion, Uzowulu was guilty."
"It is a lie,"
Uzowulu shouted. 2 years ago," continued Odukwe, "when she was pregnant, he beat her until she miscarried."
"It is a lie. She miscarried after she had gone to sleep with her lover." "Uzowulu's body, I salute you," said Evil Forest, silencing him. "What kind of lover sleeps with a pregnant woman?" There was a loud murmur of approbation from the crowd. Odukwe continued. "Last year, when my sister was recovering from an illness, he beat her again, so that if the neighbors had not gone in to save her, she would have been killed. We heard of it, and did, as you have been told. The law of Umwofia is that if a woman runs away from her husband, her bride price is returned. But in this case, she ran away to save her life.
Her two children belong to Uzowulu. We do not dispute it, but they are too young to leave their mother. If, in the other hand, Uzowulu should recover from his madness and come in the proper way to beg his wife to return, she will do so, on the understanding that if he ever beats her again, we shall cut off his genitals for him.
The crowd roared with laughter. Evil Forest rose to his feet, and order was immediately restored. A steady cloud of smoke rose from his head. He sat down again and called two witnesses. They were both Uzowulu's neighbors, and they agreed about the beating. Evil Forest then stood up, pulled out his staff, and thrust it into the earth again. He ran a few steps in the direction of the women. They all fled in terror, only to return to their places almost immediately. The nine Egugu then went away to consult together in their house. They were silent for a long time. Then the metal gong sounded, and the flute was blown. The Egugu had emerged once again from their underground home. They saluted one another, and then reappeared on the Ilo.
"Umwofia Kwenu!"
roared Evil Forest, facing the elders and grandees of the clan.
"Yah!"
replied the thunderous crowd. Then silence descended from the sky and swallowed the noise. Evil Forest began to speak, and all the while he spoke, everyone was silent. The eight other Egugu were as still as statues.
"We have heard both sides of the case," said Evil Forest. "Our duty is not to blame this man or to praise that, but to settle the dispute."
He turned to Uzowulu's group and allowed a short pause.
"Uzowulu's body, I salute you," he said.
"Our father, my hand has touched the ground," replied Uzowulu, touching the earth.
"Uzowulu's body, do you know me?"
"How can I know you, father? You are beyond our knowledge," Uzowulu replied.
"I am Evil Forest. I kill a man on the day that his life is sweetest to him."
"That is true," replied Uzowulu.
"Go to your in-laws with a pot of wine and beg your wife to return to you. It is not bravery when a man fights with a woman."
He turned to Odukwe and allowed a brief pause.
"Odukwe's body, I greet you," he said.
"My hand is on the ground," replied Odukwe.
"Do you know me?"
"No man can know you," replied Odukwe.
"I am Evil Forest. I am dry meat that fills the mouth. I am fire that burns without faggots. If your in-law brings wine to you, let your sister go with him. I salute you."
He pulled his staff from the hard earth and thrust it back.
"Umwofia Kwenu,"
he roared, and the crowd answered.
"I don't know why such a trifle should come before the Egugu," said one elder to another. "Don't you know what kind of man Uzowulu is? He will not listen to any other decision," replied the other.
As they spoke, two other groups of people had replaced the first before the Egugu, and a great land case began.
Chapter 11. The night was impenetrably dark. The moon had been rising later and later every night, until now it was seen only at dawn. And whenever the moon forsook evening and rose at cockcrow, the nights were as black as charcoal. Azinma and her mother sat on a mat on the floor after their supper of yam fufu
and bitter leaf soup. A palm oil lamp gave out yellowish light. Without it, it would have been impossible to eat. One could not have known where one's mouth was in the darkness of that night. There was an oil lamp in all the four huts on Okonkwo's compound, and each hut, seen from the others, looked like a soft eye of yellow half-light set in the solid massiveness of night. The world was silent, except for the shrill cry of insects, which was part of the night, and the sound of wooden mortar and pestle as Nwayeke pounded her fufu. Nwayeke lived four compounds away, and she was notorious for her late cooking. Every woman in the neighborhood knew the sound of Nwayeke's mortar and pestle. It was also part of the night. Okonkwo had eaten from his wife's dishes and was now reclining with his back against the wall. He searched his bag and brought out his snuff bottle. He turned it onto his left palm, but nothing came out. He hit the bottle against his knee to shake up the tobacco. That was always the trouble with Okeke's snuff. It very quickly went damp, and there was too much saltpeter in it. Okonkwo had not bought snuff from him for a long time. Idigo was the man who knew how to grind good snuff, but he had recently fallen ill. Low voices, broken now and again by singing, reached Okonkwo from his wives' huts as each woman and her children told folk stories. Ekwefi and her daughter, Ezinma, sat on a mat on the floor. It was Ekwefi's turn to tell a story. "Once upon a time," she began, "all the birds were invited to a feast in the sky. They were very happy, and began to prepare themselves for the great day. They painted their bodies with red cam wood and drew beautiful patterns on them with uli. Tortoise saw all these preparations and soon discovered what it all meant. Nothing that happened in the world of the animals ever escaped his notice. He was full of cunning. As soon as he heard of the great feast in the sky, his throat began to itch at the very thought. There was a famine in those days, and Tortoise had not eaten a good meal for 2 moons. His body rattled like a piece of dry stick in his empty shell. So he began to plan how he would go to the sky. "But he had no wings," said Ezinma. "Be patient," replied her mother. "That is the story. Tortoise had no wings. But he went to the birds and asked to be allowed to go with them." "We know you too well," said the birds when they had heard him. "You are full of cunning, and you are ungrateful. If we allow you to come with us, you will soon begin your mischief." "You do not know me," said Tortoise. "I am a changed man. I have learned that a man who makes trouble for others is also making it for himself." Tortoise had a sweet tongue, and within a short time all the birds agreed that he was a changed man, and they each gave him a feather, with which he made 2 wings. At last the great day came, and Tortoise was the first to arrive at the meeting place. When all the birds had gathered together, they set off in a body. Tortoise was very happy and voluble as he flew among the birds, and he was soon chosen as the man to speak for the party because he was a great orator. "There is one important thing which we must not forget," he said as they flew on their way. "When people are invited to a great feast like this, they take new names for the occasion. Our hosts in the sky will expect us to honor this age-old custom." None of the birds had heard of this custom, but they knew that Tortoise, in spite of his failings in other directions, was a widely traveled man who knew the customs of different peoples, and so they each took a new name. When they had all taken, Tortoise also took one. He was to be called All of You. At last the party arrived in the sky, and their hosts were very happy to see them. Tortoise stood up in his many-colored plumage and thanked them for their invitation. His speech was so eloquent that all the birds were glad they had brought him, and nodded their heads in approval of all he said. Their hosts took him as king of the birds, especially as he looked somewhat different from the others. After kola nuts had been presented and eaten, the people of the sky set before their guests the most delectable dishes Tortoise had ever seen or dreamed of. The soup was brought out hot from the fire, and in the very pot in which it had been cooked. It was full of meat and fish. Tortoise began to sniff aloud. There was pounded yam, and also yam pottage, cooked with palm oil and fresh fish. There were also pots of palm wine. When everything had been set before the guests, one of the people of the sky came forward and tasted a little from each pot. He then invited the birds to eat, but Tortoise jumped to his feet and asked, "For whom have you prepared this feast?" "For all of you," replied the man. Tortoise turned to the birds and said, "You remember that my name is All of You. The custom here is to serve the spokesman first and the others later. They will serve you when I have eaten." He began to eat, and the birds grumbled angrily. The people of the sky thought it must be their custom to leave all the food for their king. And so Tortoise ate the best part of the food and then drank two pots of palm wine so that he was full of food and drink and his body filled out in his shell. The birds gathered round to eat what was left and to peck at the bones he had thrown all about the floor. Some of them were too angry to eat. They chose to fly home on an empty stomach. But before they left, each took back the feather he had lent to Tortoise. And there he stood, in his hard shell full of food and wine, but without any wings to fly home. He asked the birds to take a message for his wife, but they all refused. In the end, Parrot, who had felt more angry than the others, suddenly changed his mind and agreed to take the message. "Tell my wife," said Tortoise, "to bring out all the soft things in my house and cover the compound with them so that I can jump down from the sky without very great danger." Parrot promised to deliver the message and then flew away. But when he reached Tortoise's house, he told his wife to bring out all the hard things in the house. And so she brought out her husband's hoes, machetes, spears, guns, and even his cannon. Tortoise looked down from the sky and saw his wife bringing things out, but it was too far to see what they were. When all seemed ready, he let himself go. He fell and fell and fell until he began to fear that he would never stop falling. And then, like the sound of his cannon, he crashed on the compound.
"Did he die?" asked Azinma.
"No," replied Ekwefi. "His shell broke into pieces, but there was a great medicine man in the neighborhood. Tortoise's wife sent for him, and he gathered all the bits of shell and stuck them together. That is why Tortoise's shell is not smooth."
"There is no song in the story," Azinma pointed out.
"No," said Ekwefi. "I shall think of another one with a song. But it is your turn now."
"Once upon a time," Azinma began, "Tortoise and Cat went to wrestle against yams." "No, that is not the beginning. Once upon a time, there was a great famine in the land of animals. Everybody was lean, except Cat, who was fat, and whose body shone as if oil was rubbed on it."
She broke off, because at that very moment a loud and high-pitched voice
broke the outer silence of the night. It was Cielo, the priestess of Agbala, prophesying. There was nothing new in that. Once in a while, Cielo was possessed by the spirit of her god, and she began to prophesy. But tonight, she was addressing her prophecy and greetings to Okonkwo. And so everyone in his family listened. The folk stories stopped.
Agbala do! Agbala ekeneo!
Came the voice like a sharp knife cutting through the night.
Okonkwo! Agbala ekene jio! Agbala cholu ifu ada ya ezin mao!
At the mention of Ezinma's name, Ekwefe jerked her head sharply like an animal that had sniffed death in the air. Her heart jumped painfully within her. The priestess had now reached Okonkwo's compound and was talking with him outside his hut. She was saying again and again that Agbala wanted to see his daughter, Ezinma. Okonkwo pleaded with her to come back in the morning because Ezinma was now asleep. But Cielo ignored what he was trying to say and went on shouting that Agbala wanted to see his daughter. Her voice was as clear as metal, and Okonkwo's women and children heard from their huts all that she said. Okonkwo was still pleading that the girl had been ill of late and was asleep. Ekwefi quickly took her to their bedroom and placed her on their high bamboo bed. The priestess screamed.
"Beware, Okonkwo," she warned. "Beware of exchanging words with Agbala. Does a man speak when a god speaks? Beware!"
She walked through Okonkwo's hut into the circular compound and went straight toward Ekwefi's hut. Okonkwo came after her.
"Ekwefi," she called. "Agbala greets you. Where is my daughter, Ezinma? Agbala wants to see her."
Ekwefi came out from her hut, carrying her oil lamp in her left hand. There was a light wind blowing, so she cupped her right hand to shelter the flame. Nwoye's mother, also carrying an oil lamp, emerged from her hut. The children stood in the darkness outside their hut watching the strange event. Okonkwo's youngest wife also came out and joined the others.
"Where does Agbala want to see her?" Ekwefi asked.
"Where else but in his house in the hills and the caves," replied the priestess.
"I will come with you too," Ekwefi said firmly.
"Tufia!"
the priestess cursed, her voice cracking like the angry bark of thunder in the dry season.
"How dare you, woman, to go before the mighty Agbala of your own accord? Beware, woman, lest he strike you in his anger. Bring me my daughter!"
Ekwefi went into her hut and came out again with Ezinma.
"Come, my daughter," said the priestess. "I shall carry you on my back.
A baby on its mother's back does not know that the way is long." Ezinma began to cry. She was used to Cielo calling her my daughter, but it was a different Cielo she now saw in the yellow half-light.
"Don't cry, my daughter," said the priestess, "lest Agbala be angry with you."
"Don't cry," said Ekwefi. "She will bring you back very soon. I shall give you some fish to eat."
She went into the hut again and brought down the smoke-black basket in which she kept her dried fish and other ingredients for cooking soup. She broke a piece in two and gave it to Ezinma, who clung to her.
"Don't be afraid," said Ekwefi,
stroking her head, which was shaved in places, leaving a regular pattern of hair. They went outside again. The priestess bent down on one knee, and Ezinma climbed on her back. her left palm closed on her fish, and her eyes gleaming with tears.
Agbalado, Agbala Ekeneo.
Chielo began once again to chant greetings to her god. She turned round sharply and walked through Okonkwo's hut, bending very low at the eaves. Ezinma was crying loudly now, calling on her mother. The two voices disappeared into the thick darkness. A strange and sudden weakness descended on Ekwefi as she stood gazing in the direction of the voices, like a hen whose only chick has been carried away by a kite. Ezinma's voice soon faded away, and only Chielo was heard moving farther and farther into the distance.
"Why do you stand there, as though she had been kidnapped?" asked Okonkwo, as he went back to his hut.
"She will bring her back soon," Nwoye's mother said. But Ekwefi did not hear these consolations. She stood for a while, and then all of a sudden made up her mind. She hurried through Okonkwo's hut and went outside.
"Where are you going?" he asked.
"I am following Chielo," she replied, and disappeared in the darkness. Okonkwo cleared his throat and brought out his snuff bottle from the goatskin bag by his side. The priestess's voice was already growing faint in the distance. Ekwefi hurried to the main footpath and turned left in the direction of the voice. Her eyes were useless to her in the darkness, but she picked her way easily on the sandy footpath, hedged on either side by branches and damp leaves. She began to run, holding her breasts with her hands to stop them flapping noisily against her body. She hit her left foot against an outcropped root, and terror seized her. It was an ill omen. She ran faster, but Chielo's voice was still a long way away. Had she been running too? How could she go so fast with Ezinma on her back? Although the night was cool, Ekwefi was beginning to feel hot from her running. She continually ran into the luxuriant weeds and creepers that walled in the path. Once, she tripped up and fell. Only then did she realize, with a start, that Chielo had stopped her chanting. Her heart beat violently, and she stood still. Then Chielo's renewed outburst came from only a few paces ahead. But Ekwefi could not see her. She shut her eyes for a while and opened them again in an effort to see. But it was useless. She could not see beyond her nose. There were no stars in the sky because there was a rain cloud. Fireflies went about with their tiny green lamps, which only made the darkness more profound. Between Chielo's outbursts, the night was alive with the shrill tremor of forest insects woven into the darkness.
Agbalado, Agbala Ekeneo.
Ekwefi trudged behind, neither getting too near nor keeping too far back. She thought they must be going towards the sacred cave. Now that she walked slowly, she had time to think. What would she do when they got to the cave? She would not dare to enter. She would wait at the mouth, all alone in that fearful place. She thought of all the terrors of the night. She remembered that night, long ago, when she had seen Ogbu Agali Odu, one of those evil essences loosed upon the world by the potent medicines which the tribe had made in the distant past against its enemies, but had now forgotten how to control. Ekwefi had been returning from the stream with her mother on a dark night like this when they saw its glow as it flew in their direction. They had thrown down their water pots and lain by the roadside expecting the sinister light to descend on them and kill them. That was the only time Ekwefi ever saw Ogbu Agali Odu. But although it had happened so long ago, her blood still ran cold whenever she remembered that night. The priestess's voice came at longer intervals now, but its vigor was undiminished. The air was cool and damp with dew. Ezinma sneezed. Akwefi muttered, "Life to you." At the same time, the priestess also said, "Life to you, my daughter." Ezinma's voice from the darkness warmed her mother's heart. She trudged slowly along. And then the priestess screamed.
"Somebody is walking behind me," she said. "Whether you are spirit or man, may Agbala shave your head with a blunt razor. May he twist your neck until you see your heels."
Akwefi stood rooted on the spot. One mind said to her, "Woman, go home before Agbala does you harm." But she could not. She stood until Chielo had increased the distance between them, and she began to follow again. She had already walked so long that she began to feel a slight numbness in the limbs and in the head. Then it occurred to her that they could not have been heading for the cave. They must have bypassed it long ago. They must be going towards Umuachi, the farthest village in the clan. Chielo's voice now came after long intervals. It seemed to Akwefi that the night had become a little lighter. The cloud had lifted, and a few stars were out. The moon must be preparing to rise, its sullenness over. When the moon rose, late in the night, people said it was refusing food, as a sullen husband refuses his wife's food when they have quarreled.
"Agbala, do! Umuachi! Agbala, ekene! Unuo!"
It was just as Akwefi had thought. The priestess was now saluting the village of Umuachi. It was unbelievable, the distance they had covered. As they emerged into the open village from the narrow forest track, the darkness was softened, and it became possible to see the vague shape of trees. Akwefi screwed her eyes up in an effort to see her daughter and the priestess, but whenever she thought she saw their shape, it immediately dissolved, like a melting lump of darkness. She walked numbly along. Chielo's voice was now rising continuously, as when she first set out. Akwefi had a feeling of spacious openness, and she guessed they must be on the village Ilo, or playground. And she realized, too, with something like a jerk, that Chielo was no longer moving forward. She was, in fact, returning. Akwefi quickly moved away from her line of retreat. Chielo passed by, and they began to go back the way they had come. It was a long and weary journey, and Akwefi felt like a sleepwalker most of the way. The moon was definitely rising, and although it had not yet appeared on the sky, its light had already melted down the darkness. Akwefi could now discern the figure of the priestess and her burden. She slowed down her pace so as to increase the distance between them. She was afraid of what might happen if Chielo suddenly turned round and saw her. She had prayed for the moon to rise, but now she found the half-light of the incipient moon more terrifying than darkness. The world was now peopled with vague, fantastic figures that dissolved under her steady gaze and then formed again in new shapes. At one stage, Akwefi was so afraid that she nearly called out to Chielo for companionship and human sympathy. What she had seen was the shape of a man climbing a palm tree, his head pointing to the earth and his legs skywards. But at that very moment, Chielo's voice rose again in her possessed chanting, and Akwefi recoiled, because there was no humanity there.
It was not the same Chielo, who sat with her in the market and sometimes bought bean cakes for Ezinma, whom she called her daughter. It was a different woman, the priestess of Agbala, the oracle of the hills and caves. Akwefi trudged along between two fears. The sound of her benumbed steps seemed to come from some other person walking behind her. Her arms were folded across her bare breasts. Dew fell heavily, and the air was cold. She could no longer think, not even about the terrors of night. She just jogged along in a half-sleep, only waking to full life when Chielo sang. At last, they took a turning and began to head for the caves. From then on, Chielo never ceased in her chanting. She greeted her god in a multitude of names, the owner of the future, the messenger of earth, the god who cut a man down when his life was sweetest to him. Ekwefi was also awakened, and her benumbed fears revived. The moon was now up, and she could see Chielo and Ezinma clearly. How a woman could carry a child of that size so easily and for so long was a miracle. But Ekwefi was not thinking about that. Chielo was not a woman that night.
Agbala do! Agbala ekeneo! Chi negbu madu ubosi ndu ya nato ya uto daluo!
Ekwefi could already see the hills looming in the moonlight. They formed a circular ring with a break at one point, through which the foot track led to the center of the circle. As soon as the priestess stepped into this ring of hills, her voice was not only doubled in strength, but was thrown back on all sides. It was indeed the shrine of a great god. Ekwefi picked her way carefully and quietly. She was already beginning to doubt the wisdom of her coming. Nothing would happen to Ezinma, she thought. And if anything happened to her, could she stop it? She would not dare to enter the underground caves. Her coming was quite useless, she thought. As these things went through her mind, she did not realize how close they were to the cave mouth. And so, when the priestess, with Ezinma on her back, disappeared through a hole hardly big enough to pass a hen, Ekwefi broke into a run as though to stop them. As she stood gazing at the circular darkness which had swallowed them, tears gushed from her eyes, and she swore within her that if she heard Ezinma cry, she would rush into the cave to defend her against all the gods in the world. She would die with her. Having sworn that oath, she sat down on a stony ledge and waited. Her fear had vanished. She could hear the priestess's voice, all its metal taken out of it by the vast emptiness of the cave. She buried her face in her lap and waited. She did not know how long she waited. It must have been a very long time. Her back was turned on the footpath that led out of the hills. She must have heard a noise behind her and turned round sharply. A man stood there with a machete in his hand. Ekwefi uttered a scream and sprang to her feet.
"Don't be foolish," said Okonkwo's voice. "I thought you were going into the shrine with Chielo," he mocked.
Ekwefi did not answer. Tears of gratitude filled her eyes. She knew her daughter was safe.
"Go home and sleep," said Okonkwo. "I shall wait here."
"I shall wait too. It is almost dawn. The first cock has crowed."
As they stood there together, Ekwefi's mind went back to the days when they were young
She had married a nene because Okonkwo was too poor then to marry. 2 years after her marriage to a nene, she could bear it no longer, and she ran away to Okonkwo. It had been early in the morning. The moon was shining. She was going to the stream to fetch water. Okonkwo's house was on the way to the stream. She went in and knocked at his door, and he came out. Even in those days, he was not a man of many words. He just carried her into his bed, and in the darkness, began to feel around her waist for the loose end of her cloth.
This ends Disc 3.